And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. We talk about ancient mysteries and modern mysteries all across the globe. All sorts of interesting topics. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. And I've been on about 2 years now, and I really want to thank the audience for traveling on this Odyssey and this journey with me. We've interviewed amazing guests from all across the globe, and I've built up quite an archive, too, and we'll talk about that a bit tonight. I'm going to stroll down memory lane with you. And I have a very special message about money and the economy toward the end of the show. People are really worried about the dollar losing its value, and I want to talk about the history of the dollar and the Federal Reserve banking system and get into that so we can see how we got traveled down this wrong road and how we can fix it, how we can correct it. I always want to stay positive. I don't want to just dish out negative news. I want to tell people about it so they're aware of everything, but I always am going to put a positive spin on everything, and that's where I'm coming from. And this is a very positive network, BBS Radio, and that's why I'm here, actually. So without any further ado, tonight's kind of a lecture night. Just go ahead and relax, take it easy. We're going to talk about ancient mysteries, and I'm going to be referring to all of the research I do in conjunction with my movies, The Sands of Time and The Temples of Stone. So we're going to start off in Peru tonight. And if you look at South America as a whole, going back thousands of years, the architecture is very primitive and simple. These were mostly hunter-gatherer farmers, very similar to North America, that were traveling from place to place. They were nomads. But there's one area that's a great exception to this rule, and it's the present-day country of Peru. There were very, very many advanced types of architecture that were left behind that were way ahead of its time, and we're going to dig into those right now. The first one is called the Lines and Symbols of Nazca. It's spelled N-A-Z-C-A. There are deep furrows of yellow-white soil of numerous animal figures that were discovered in the 1930s in Peru. Amazingly, these figures can only be seen from aircraft. So they're really of no value to people on the ground, and it's an incredible amount of work that went into all of these elaborate monkeys and whales and birds that are all across this vast desert. Some of the symbols are over 1,000 feet long. There are long lines, some of which stretch for miles, and appear to be giant airport runways. Some of the lines are in bizarre geometric patterns. Nazca is the driest region on Earth, and any group who wanted to preserve symbols for centuries would choose Nazca as the best palette for their symbols if they had this advanced geographic knowledge. In the vicinity of Nazca are rocks with drawings of men with rays shooting out of their hands. How could primitive people form these animal creatures so perfectly, and how would they know about shooting ray guns? So, in other words, you'd have to almost check this work by aircraft to make it perfect. And the first person to bring this knowledge forward was Erich von Däniken, of course, in the 1960s. Just by the way, he has admitted he's made some mistakes with some of his research, but he has gone back in his later books and corrected a lot of this research, and is still writing books to this day. He has over 20 books at this point. So please check out his later books, which are more accurate. Whenever you're a pioneer in a new field, you're going to make some mistakes, but he's still out there and working. So there are no hills nearby to really view them, and they cannot be discerned on ground level, like I said before. As for legends, the indigenous people, the Incas, say that the symbols were not made by man, but they are the works of the gods, the demigods, specifically the Viracochas. So they don't take credit for the Nazca lines. They point to the long-lost past and these Anunnaki gods who came down from the heavens and created these symbols. The lines are parallel in some cases, running for miles through riverbeds and rocky areas. They appear to be some type of runway created by giants. They were estimated to be created at 350 BC to 600 AD, and that was the heyday for societies and pyramid building in Peru and Mexico. It very much appears that the demigods, the Anunnaki of the Middle East, who disappeared about 1000 BC, transferred over to South America first, most likely in search of minerals, copper, tin, gold, and bronze, and continued their same architecture, their pyramid building in this region. One of the Nazca symbols, by the way, is an alien type of creature. It looks very much like one of the gray aliens that you see in common literature today. Another one is a spider figure containing a diagram of the constellation of Orion, and they may be pointing to their possible home base, originally, of Orion. So now let's move over to England and talk about Stonehenge. Evidence dates the site of Stonehenge back to 3000 BC. There are 60 standing blue stones, and they had a mathematical system based on the number 60, which we still use to this day, of course, with our timekeeping and many other numerical functions. So the stones are placed to predict astronomy alignments, such as the equinox, and it's indicative of a very advanced knowledge of astronomy and the lunar cycles and many things that were beyond the grasp of primitive man as we know. For instance, scientists only discovered Pluto, which is, right in our solar system, in the past 100 years. But they had quite advanced knowledge going back several thousand years. Now, in addition to the blue stones, there are 82 large stones that weigh 4 tons, the standing stones, and they were transported 240 miles from the stone quarry. So 4 tons is 8,000 pounds. And they were carved in one piece somehow, which is almost nearly an impossible feat for a primitive tribe or people to do. And remember, they did not have wheels, so somehow these giant blocks and stones were transported. And to researchers in my field, it's indicative of advanced technology and the Anunnaki helping out. The other group of stones, the Saracen stones, are much larger and taller. They weigh 50 tons. Some weigh 30 tons, some weigh 40 tons on average. So now we're talking a tremendous amount of weight, 60,000, 80,000, or 100,000 pounds. And these were transferred from a quarry 25 miles away, so quite a long distance in this case. And once again, when archaeologists look at primitive tools, the little copper knives, if you try to cut out a giant stone in a quarry, the tool is going to snap in half. It's just going to disappear because this is basalt and andesite and very hard granite that would snap these tools. And these stones are always cut in a precision-like manner, almost as if by laser or some type of advanced tool. So it's quite intriguing. So now let's move over to the Great Pyramids of Egypt. The Great Pyramid of Giza is not filled with the treasures of dead kings. That was for some of the smaller pyramids that came along later. And there's an absence of mummies and treasure in the Great Pyramid of Giza. In fact, it's almost completely solid, except for a few empty chambers. There are no Egyptian hieroglyphics, which is very strange for a society that covered their artwork and their monuments with them. Many researchers in my field simply feel that the empty chambers held a large crystal, and they had crystal technology, and it was beamed through the shafts up into the air. And if you've ever been to Las Vegas and you've seen the Pyramid Luxor Hotel, what's the first thing you see is this giant light shining up into the air. And I think that they are mimicking this ancient technology. It was a beacon for a spacecraft coming in and landing, and the four sides of the pyramid were aligned north, south, east, and west, and it was on a perfect longitude line of 33 degrees, which cut the Earth into thirds. So it's an excellent compass or marking point from space. So the Great Pyramid of Giza appears to have little purpose or use to serve human beings. There certainly weren't any windows and doors or places to live or even look out and rule over people down below. It appears to be a creation for another race based not upon this earth. 2.3 million blocks had to be quarried and carved out and moved into place. Precision cut blocks weighing 16 tons were fitted together with a seamless seal. And when studying the traces left behind. We're always looking for this precision type of construction that was much more advanced than the kind of thrown together building blocks of the primitives. This was very advanced. The largest stones in the pyramid weighed 400 tons. Of course, extremely difficult to quarry, move, and construct, and move inside the pyramid. The base was 13 acres and was leveled to a degree only accurate today with laser technology. The base was squared true north, even though the compass had not been invented. It was originally encased in limestone, which is able to reflect off the sun, able to cast a bright reflection into space. And once again, this may have been very helpful to incoming spacecraft. And we, as I said before, the alignment is 30 degrees north and 30 degrees longitude east. It's on an exact line that cuts the Earth into thirds from space. So let's talk about obelisks that were also built in Egypt. Those are those very tall monoliths that you see all throughout the region of Egypt and beyond. For instance, the Washington Monument in D.C. is a replica of an obelisk. That gives you an idea of its shape. So they were replicas of what the pharaohs had seen before, the rocket ships of the gods. And the Sphinx, were very heavy also, in many cases, weighing 300 tons, 400 tons. There's a very famous one in Aswan in Egypt, and it was never completely finished. You can see it sitting there in the quarry if you ever visit that area. The Sphinx is a half-lion, half-human. It's a representation of a hybrid animal-human creature that we see over and over in Egyptian art, as well as the Greek legends and tales and the Roman legends. The Egyptian society was also characterized by advanced knowledge appearing suddenly in the areas of science, art, writing, language, math, astronomy, and architecture. In other words, you don't see primitive math or primitive astronomy. It all appeared all at once as if it was handed to them by an outside source. Egyptians believed that gods descended from the skies and created the idea of a king ruler ruling over the masses rather than a freer hunter-gatherer society. They believed in a pantheon of gods who had human-like qualities ranging from compassion to rage to jealousy to joy, just like human beings. Walter Emery is a professor of Egyptology, and he studied this society for years and years, and he finally concluded that a great change took place suddenly in the era of 3400 BC. Society developed to an astonishing degree, all of a sudden. He was left with a strong impression of an indirect connection and the existence of outside third-party intervention. There are also pyramids on Mars, by the way. Scientists have captured photographs from space showing a grouping of pyramids, as well as a human face, known as the face on Mars. And they call this area Cydonia, and you can look those pictures up online if you type in Cydonia, C-Y-D-O-N-I-A. And it's very tantalizing evidence. As you look into the Sumerian clay tablets, they do talk about building a base on the fourth planet from the sun, Mars, and using it more as a transport base for gold. Not so much a settlement for many, many people and Anunnaki like on Earth, because the conditions were much more harsh on Mars and there was no oxygen. But they did create a small base there, according to the clay tablets. So speaking of these tablets, let's get into Sumeria, the world's oldest civilization. In the 1850s, archaeologists discovered clumps of dirt in Sumeria, modern-day Iraq. They excavated these areas and found thousands of clay tablets with cuneiform writing dating back to 5000 BC. Eventually, over 500,000 of these tablets were found and can be found at museums all over the world today. They were not widely translated and distributed to the Western world until the 1970s, when scholar Zachariah Sitchin wrote a series of books translating the cuneiform into English. And they were able to find an ancient language called Akkadian, a very obscure language. And they were able to find tablets with translations from cuneiform to Akkadian, and that was the key. The tablets state that human-like creatures of ET origin ruled human society as Earth's first monarchs. The Sumerian gods traveled the skies with rockets and globes. Ancient carvings depict gods wearing goggles over their eyes. Now, if you take college courses or traditional studies, they always say, well, this is all mythology. But what a lot of people don't know is, I would say 70% of these tablets are accounting. They're boring accounting records. For instance, 20 heads of cattle is worth, 35 shekels. And it's trading and it's accounting records. It's receipts. So if this is all mythology, why are they writing down all of these thousands of receipts? Shouldn't they just be telling entertaining stories? So to me, a lot of this is quite boring, mundane information. And to me, it points out the fact that it's very real. It's not mythology at all. It may not be totally accurate. Things change over time. But they certainly give a pretty strong indication that there was an ET race at this time. This custodial race, and I never refer to them as God with a capital G, by the way. I always refer to them as the demigods or custodians or the pretender gods, because they are our relatives, but they are not the supreme God of the universe, who they believe in and who we believe in, and who created the sun and the stars and the moon and all of us, ultimately. So this custodial race was capable of love and hatred, amusement, anger, honesty, and deception. They had complete custody of the human race at that time. Sumeria was divided into 12 major city-states, all centered around ziggurats, or pyramid. Each was ruled by its own demigod. Public buildings spiraled around each temple with elaborate irrigation and agricultural systems such as dams, dikes, and canals. And much later in South America, these same advanced dams, dikes, and canals appear in Peru. It's the same type of architecture, repeated over and over. They developed a writing system, the wheel, schools, medical science, a congress, taxation, laws, money, mapping, shipbuilding, and a detailed knowledge of astronomy. They created a calendar based on the sun and the moon's rotation. They created a timekeeping system based on 60. They created a zodiac cycle of 25,920 years, or approximately 2,000 years for each zodiac sign. But their society only lasted a couple thousand years, and this cycle is almost 26,000 years, so it's indicative of a much lengthier time frame and a legacy of demigods off this planet who may have lived much longer. They mapped out the planets of the solar system, even though distant planets such as Pluto were only discovered in the last century. The humans of this time all believed in multiple gods or pantheism, and who descended from the heavens down to this planet. And that's referred to very obliquely in the Old Testament of the Bible as the Nephilim falling down or the giants. Certainly the Romans believed in this family, and it was Zeus, at the top of the hill, and then six main male gods and six main female gods. The Greeks had the same main gods and the six male gods and the six female gods. And some of them even had the same name, like Apollo. Excuse me, Zeus refers to the Greek god. So anyway, they had similar characteristics but different names. For instance, the Roman god Neptune, the god of the sea, corresponds to the Greek god Poseidon, the god of the sea. So there was a hierarchy of gods. Zachariah Sitchin calls them the Anunnaki. I call them the custodians, including lesser gods of brick molding, metal smithing, weapons building, etc. So before the custodians, there were really no specialists in human society. This was their creation. This elaborate social structure of specialization was taught to us instead of the kind of communities where everybody shares. They divided us into these categories. So some of the other inventions that occurred around 3400 BC were musical instruments, baking kilns for clay, the bronzing arts, which require very precise formulas to create bronze. It's not something that you would really randomly discover. You have to know formulas, but they all of a sudden had these formulas appear. Chariots were created, astrology, of course, and the ball and socket construction used to make the precision cornerstones of the pyramid structures. So let's get into the official story of the custodians as recorded on the clay tablets. It is as follows. Let me take a breath here. Okay, so, and I just want to remind everybody before I get into this, I've produced two DVDs on this subject, and we've recently revamped my webpage. If you go to Mondays at 8 p.m., check out Odyssey, go to my archives, you'll see my picture and a bio of myself, and my DVDs have been scanned, the front covers and the back covers, with all of the details. So tonight I'm talking a lot about the Sands of Time, which is an overview of the ancient astronaut theory. And then later in the program, I'm going to get into that information about the dollar and money, which is in my second DVD, The Temples of Stone. So please click on my archive information, my webpage at Odyssey, and please order them. I'll ship them out to you for $20 each. I use PayPal. And then you can see pictures, because this is very visual. I know it's hard over the radio, but I have over 100 pictures. And this is what supports the show, actually, that I don't have commercials. You know, so many network shows, you have commercials and newscasts that you have to stop for. It's tedious and endlessly annoying. But my shows, as you know, it's an hour straight through. And I really count on you to purchase these DVDs, show them to your friends. They're great at parties. This is all taught as theory. It's theory backed by hard evidence. So it's up to you to speculate on your own and maybe go on your own path that may be a bit different from mine. I was raised very conservatively Christian, and that is my imprint. That is my background. Maybe some of you weren't, but I always kind of refer back to traditional Christianity because that's who I came from. Many, many years in the Methodist Church growing up. And so anyway, check that out. So the official story is 450,000 years ago, the custodians came from a planet called Martek, which was also in our solar system. Some people call this Nibiru or Planet X. They were in search of gold, which they were going to process into particles and spray into their atmosphere to protect their ozone, because they had destroyed it through war and pollution. See, I told you they were a lot like us. They're almost like our cousins or uncles or relatives. We share genetics. We share a lot. I almost hesitate to call them ETs. They're very much like us. So they had polluted their environment. They needed to find another planet with some minerals on it. 50 custodians landed in the Arabian Sea. Their leader was a brilliant, benevolent engineer named Enki. They extracted gold from the mines in Africa. They went right to work. They hauled it by ship to Mesopotamia. They smelted the gold and refined it, and then sent it up to their spacecraft for transport home. 600 more custodians arrived later, and the leader of this new group was named Enlil. He was a cruel and selfish type of character. Enki and Enlil were both the sons of Anu, who was the ruler of their home planet. Enlil was a closer blood relative, but Enki was more skilled and talented with engineering. So keep in mind this concept of dualism, of one benevolent god and one evil god. Much later, the same two personalities really fight it out in Mexico, and it's very well documented. Different names, but same two Anunnaki fighting each other for control of the land and the minerals. So they mined gold for thousands of years, but they began to complain about the hard work. They declared a mutiny against Enlil, and he was forced to call in his father Anu from the home planet. Anu decided to shut down the gold mining operations. And there is extensive evidence of ancient gold mines in Zimbabwe and Africa, dating back 70,000 years. What on earth would primitive man be doing, digging down way deep into the earth? And the gold wasn't in nuggets like they found in California, okay? It wasn't like that. It was within the veins of the rocks, and you needed a chemical formula to remove it out of the rocks. It was complex and very difficult. So I don't think primitive man would go to all this trouble on his own at all. They were more concerned with food, shelter, you know. So once again, to me, this points to another group with another agenda completely. But you can certainly look into the great Zimbabwe ruins. And the structures themselves are newer, but the gold mines, all of the material in there is organic, has been dated back to 70,000 BC. So Enki offered a solution. He asked to create a hybrid between the primitive ape man of Africa and the custodians, the custodial gods, to perform the work. So this is the explanation of the missing link that has baffled scientists forever. There was this sudden jump from ape man to modern day man without any development or evolution. It's because the Anunnaki came in and engineered it, this change. So the original purpose of creating humans was to be a slave race to mine gold, and I don't want that to freak you out at all, okay? I'm just telling you what the Sumerian clay tablets say, and once again, we are very much like the Anunnaki, and we have a soul, and that's almost a separate discussion. I'm not going to get into that, but we very much are like them, and there is a supreme God above us all. So Anu the father gave permission to create a primitive worker. After much genetic trial and error, they created Homo sapiens, though man was unable to procreate, similar to a mule. Enlil became jealous of Enki's creation, and he seized upon some of the humans and brought them to Mesopotamia, to the Garden of Eden, which they called Edin. Meanwhile, Enki created an improved version of the humans, one who had greater intelligence, who could procreate, and who had an eternal soul. There was a debate among the custodians at this point. They needed to animate these workers, but they did not want to give them an eternal soul, a piece of the divine spark of the God of the universe, which they possessed. They felt that at some point the humans would gain their freedom and overtake them on this planet, which is exactly what we did. But nevertheless, they decided to go ahead with this improved version of a human being. So at that point, we became like them, and they became, they were like us. No difference. The symbol for Enki's laboratory was two snakes entwined like a strand of DNA, which is the symbol we use for medicine today. If you're ever wondering where the caduceus comes from, that's where it comes from. The snake is a general representation of Enki, as he is depicted as such in ancient symbols. He journeyed to the Garden of Eden and made this change or upgrade in the DNA, which is portrayed in the Bible as offering the gift of the tree of life, procreation, and the tree of knowledge, knowledge of their true identity, their past, and knowledge that they have a soul and they are eternal like the custodians, and therefore they are free. That's what the Enki, the symbol of the snake, was trying to tell them. When they were transformed with the upgrade to sexual creatures who can reproduce, they became aware of their nakedness and wore clothing from that point on. So as you can see, the story in Genesis in the Bible got all twisted around, and everything got flipped, as it is told to us today. Enlil was outraged by this situation, and he told Anu, his father. Ultimately, Anu made a decision to let Adam and Eve live as mortals with some freedoms, but with custodial control from the demigods. After the Garden of Eden intervention, Enlil demonized the concept of the snake, and Enki as being evil throughout the rest of history. Still to this day, when originally he was the opposite, offering freedom and true knowledge and life. Mankind was allowed to flourish, not just being slaves, but also gaining positions of power. So a lot of these Anunnakis, they were helpful and very beneficial. I mean, I'm not writing them all off as bad. Many of them were very, very beneficial in our past. They played music and danced, which amused and charmed the demigods. Some of them came to enjoy our company, and they chose to help us with more and more of their knowledge and passing on all this information about math and science that I talked about before. The custodians decided to mate with humans since they had the same genetic essence, or seed of life. This explains the passage in Genesis that states that the sons of the gods mated with the daughters of men and created a hybrid race of giants known as the Nephilim. And that's in Genesis 6. You can read that passage. There are giants that roamed the earth in those days, as recorded in the Old Testament. The most famous who was Goliath, who fought King David. Enlil was also upset and felt very threatened by this development. Earth was entering an ice age, and he decided to take advantage of the weather conditions. The ice caps were unstable and about to cause a huge tidal wave. The custodians made secret preparations to assemble at the spaceport, which was a huge concrete rocket platform at Baalbek, and that's in Lebanon, and they went aloft from that giant platform, which is thousands of square feet, up into space to ride out the big flood. And Enlil wanted all humans to perish in the coming flood, and Enlil's name and identity turned into Jehovah when the Bible was written down. So when I talk about Enlil, I'm talking about Jehovah. Baalbek, and you can look this up online, it's spelled Baalbek, or there's pictures in my DVDs, is the only monument, according to my research, to be built before the flood. That was it. It still stands to this day in Lebanon. And there are giant, giant blocks. Some of them weigh 1,000 tons, and they're just sitting there. Some were never completed. The Anunnaki have a history of creating elaborate projects and then abandoning them suddenly. They did it all over the world. It was amazing. But they just moved on to other things as it suited them. So Enki secretly began in one group of humans in the city of Shu-Rupak. He gave them instructions to build a large ark to escape the coming flood. This story was taken from the Sumerian clay tablets of 4000 BC and recorded later in the Old Testament. And the Bible was written down about 700 BC, by the way, 3000 years later. And this document is known as the Tale of Noah's Ark, and the same with the Garden of Eden story. But the clay tablets provide much more detail and much more backstory. So the flood event is recorded by 200 cultures all around the world. And we have records of sea life and fossils on mountaintops, even in South America. The custodians escaped by spacecraft, so many of them were very sad. They landed later on the highest dry land on Mount Ararat. And by the way, there is a fossil of a giant outline of a ship on the top of Mount Ararat that you can check out. There's a raging controversy over what it is. I believe it's the actual Noah's Ark. It's about 300 feet, just like the measurements given in the Bible, although they were referred to as cubits in the Old Testament. And it's perched right at the top of that first dry land that would recede at 15,000 feet high in Turkey on Mount Ararat. It's quite an amazing group of photos you can find if you look up Noah's Ark online. Many of the gods were overjoyed to see the Ark and the surviving humans. Enlil was, of course, very unhappy, but he was persuaded that humans were needed to reestablish civilizations on Earth, this time without interbreeding from the custodians. Well, that was the plan anyway, but they still continued to breed with the humans and custodians, and they were known as the Rephaim, the later giants of the Old Testament. They weren't quite as tall and big, and I think they had trouble reproducing because they died out about 1000 BC. The time of David and Goliath and Samson is about the last mentions of giants in the Bible. So once again, the humans settle the land and create the flourishing city of Babylon. They are in the process of creating the magnificent Tower of Babylon, when once again some of the gods are threatened. So they're just very threatened and agitated and outnumbered by human beings. This jealousy goes all throughout the Bible. But what they did was they consolidated all of the gods into one Anunnaki god called Jehovah. Even if it was Ra of Egypt or Thoth or Enlil, it was, and all the female goddesses were gone. They, you know, got rid of all of them because it was a male-dominated society like Ishtar. And they grouped them all under one umbrella. And Elohim, the word in the Bible is plural for gods. So at this point, they destroy the tower, which may have been a rocket ship, by the way. They may have had technology to build a rocket ship, this Tower of Babylon. And they disperse humans to the far corners of the earth, and they scramble their languages. This creates a pattern of divide and conquer, while strings are pulled by the custodians. And this continues to this day. I firmly believe this. I firmly believe that wars are created by this outside third party. I think the Anunnaki is still monitoring this planet. Most wars in my lifetime have not really been engineered by the people of the United States. Most people can't even find Iraq or Vietnam on a map, let alone wanting to fight them. And the wars certainly are not about taking land. So there's other agendas. There's more complex agendas. And I think the Anunnaki to this day want to keep us fighting with each other, whether it's racially or just different groups. And it's very Machiavellian, and that is their modus operandi, I think they've used all along. There's a great book called The Gods of Eden you may want to read. William Branley traces the history of war. He was just writing a book on war. He knew nothing about this, and he stumbled upon all of the ancient Anunnaki and this manipulation. So that was a very important book in my journey to read about. So Enlil was given control over Persia and Europe, which later became the seat of power of the secret societies, which he controlled. So the original Freemason group, although they were not called the Freemasons, were helping to engineer the pyramids at this time. And they have always had this knowledge that I'm talking about tonight. Enki was given the Africa region, and India was given to the female goddess named Ishtar. Enki had a son named Ra, R-A, and he created the mystery schools of Egypt and built the pyramids. He began passing on the secret knowledge of the clay tablets to a chosen few humans in the mystery schools. So once again, these were the original secret societies who were privy to this knowledge. Enlil began to play favorites and selected the tribe of the Israelites. He is described in the Old Testament as the jealous, angry, and sometimes benevolent god Jehovah, or demigod. He drove the Jews into the desert for 40 years, going to the Promised Land, which was only a distance of 250 miles, you know, but it took them 40 years. They were out there, just really struggling and having a hard time. There was a privacy factor with Jehovah, as was with all of the gods hiding inside of the ziggurats. Moses and the Israelites were not allowed to see his face. Gee, I wonder why. Maybe because they would see he was merely an Anunnaki, very similar to them. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, you know. He wanted to project a big scary image up on a screen, but if you look over in the corner, you see a little man behind the curtain. So Jehovah gave Moses the stone tablets, including the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." And then he orders them to break the commandment and kill the Canaanites and the Hittites and take their land. So a lot of it doesn't even really make any sense when you search into it. If he's telling them not to kill in the commandments, why does he then order them to kill? So he engaged in manipulation, saying that he would harden the hearts of their enemies, preventing a peaceful truce. So that's not something I believe that the supreme God of the universe would do. And this seems much more likely an earthly type of being who was pulling all of these strings. And most Christians today focus on the teachings of Jesus and do not follow many of the teachings of the Old Testament and a lot of the dogma and rituals, and you can see why, of course. So let's talk about Egyptian beliefs and ancient documents. There's a historical document that is well preserved called the Epic of Gilgamesh, and it confirms the Sumerian clay tablet information. Gilgamesh was a historical king in Babylon around 2700 BC. The poetic tale of 12 tablets describes his legendary quest for immortality. He journeys through the wilderness and the forest and has various encounters with the demigods. Eventually, he is led to one human who is immortal, Noah, and he is told the story of the flood and how Noah survived and was made immortal by the gods. He never died a mortal death. He and Enoch are the only two never to have died a mortal death. He is told of the plot by Enlil to destroy the world, and how Enki shared a secret with him and Noah's family and allowed them to survive the flood. Early Egyptian writings talk about how the ancient mystery schools were originally opposed to the enslavement of humans. They were trying to liberate humans from custodial bondage. That was their original purpose. The Egyptians wrote that the gods traveled to the heavens in flying boats, which may have been their way back then. I was talking about spacecraft. Egyptians built hundreds of pyramids for more than 2,000 different custodial gods. So it was a very elaborate belief system they had back then. The pharaohs and priests were the original secret brotherhood, and they were intermediaries, often immensely unpopular with the human population, because they were cracking the whip, telling them to, you know, help build those pyramids. The pharaohs were fooled by the custodians into believing that mummification and burial in wooden boats would preserve them and all their treasures and whisk them away to the heavens. This teaching indicates the double-crossing and insincere nature of some of the custodians, like Ra. The fact that they would double-cross even the priests and the pharaohs who helped them reach the people and convince the people to follow their orders. So they were given this false teaching about preserving the spirit, and that the spirit was tied to the body upon death, and that's why you would mummify it. Egyptian traditions held that the gods of heaven came to earth from a celestial disk. According to the pyramid text, which is an ancient document on the walls of a smaller pyramid, the pharaoh embarked on a journey for the immortality, such as the gods of Osiris, Horus, and Ra did. So the Egyptians had complex belief that the pharaohs would journey to a launch pad, enter an underground complex of tunnels and chambers, pass a power plant and radiation station, and put on suit and gear of an astronaut, and then enter a space capsule and sit between two gods. The engines would ignite, and they would ascend to the heavens. So these are their elaborate beliefs that they were taught, and it's once more indicative that maybe what the Anunnaki were doing was rewarding a select few. Maybe they would blast them off to their home planet, to Nibiru, or Planet X. Maybe some of them did make it, and this was kind of the ultimate reward, and how they kept humans in control, this promise maybe to go to their home planet. So, of course, in the Old Testament, Ezekiel writes of encounters with strange craft and possibly, you know, UFOs. He writes about metallic, shiny wheels rushing through the sky, and he describes engines with bright fire and brimstone and rims around the wheels. So it appears he's documenting a spacecraft landing. The lost book of the Old Testament, the Book of Enoch, gives a more detailed account of the Nephilim. The book was lost for centuries until it was discovered again in the 1500s. Enoch refers to the custodians as fallen angels who descend to earth and mate with the daughters of Eve to create a new breed of giants called the Nephilim. These fallen angels teach mankind how to be more warlike. There it is again, that warlike, because humans are generally peaceful. And they teach humans how to make weapons, according to Enoch. Enoch tells of the evil hybrid being wiped out later by the flood. So that's about all I'm going to cover on ancient mysteries tonight. Once again, please go to Odyssey, my webpage, and check out my DVDs, and please order them and see the pictures. You really need to see the visuals on all of this. It's a very exciting and intriguing presentation. So the first movie of mine is The Sands of Time. The second one is The Temples of Stone. And please check into this exciting DVD. You can share with your friends, have a party, and it's quite a fast journey through 90 minutes of pictures and audio. So now I want to talk about some modern issues that we're having. As all of you know, the dollar, the American dollar, is collapsing. And in my second DVD, The Temples of Stone, I get into the reasons why. And I made that DVD a couple years ago, but it's extremely timely, and I need to refer to it right now. We need to go back to 1913. What happened at that time was a group of 9 very powerful men, J.P. Morgan, Paul Warburg, or Daddy Warbucks, some of the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, who aren't even American. The Rothschilds are European royalty and bankers. They met on a private island called Jekyll Island, a very nefarious name, Jekyll Island, off the coast of Georgia, a private island. And they came up with a plan over a week or two to create the Federal Reserve banking system and move that into place that would supersede our U.S. Treasury, and they would take it over, this private cartel. You can go to Jekyll Island to this day and take a tour about how where these men created the Federal Reserve system. So federal is simply an adjective. I mean, Federal Express is not part of the government. They're a private company that delivers packages. So anyone can call them. I can enter, I can open up the federal ice cream store. You know, it's just an adjective when you see that on your dollar bill. And reserve, you know, refers to gold and silver, but they believed in fractional banking. And they immediately started printing, firing up the printing presses. And they got it through Congress through very sneaky means. I strongly suggest you watch a film online. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. It's free. Just go to Google. And once again, it's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And learn this whole history by Edward Griffin. And it's shocking. It's not something that's in our history books. If you had a public education like I did, and I went through 4 years of college this and took political history, this is not mentioned. This has been deleted, that this private group of the Rothschilds and Rockefellers took over our banking system. So what they did is gradually remove us from gold and silver, and the last president to do so and put us completely on paper money, it was Nixon in the 70s. So that's why the dollar is having major problems right now. That's why it's falling in value. The euro is taking over. And the Bilderberg Group, a very powerful group, is wanting this to happen very much. They're wanting the dollar to get so weak that we are going to be forced to merge with two other countries who are very different from us. Canada has extremely different politics, and Mexico is an extremely different system. They don't care about that. They want to merge us with these three countries, all under one giant tent, a huge economic zone, into the North American Union. Now, this has already been done in Europe. It started with trade agreements, the European Community. Simple trade agreements, so that didn't freak out any of the Europeans. Everybody liked the free trade, sounded good at the time. Well, it was simply a smokescreen to lock into permanent agreements. And we have NAFTA that was passed in 96. Bill Clinton was a Bilderberger. He went to the 91 meeting. By 92, he came out of nowhere to be president. And he implemented NAFTA. And a lot of real good American jobs, high-paying jobs, left our country at that point. And NAFTA made us partners with Canada and Mexico, so we're technically no longer a sovereign nation, independent nation. We're already locked into some partnerships. This was all done in secret without the consent or the vote of the American people or even Congress whatsoever. So please educate yourself on this issue and the dollar, and we need to get off the Federal Reserve. Ron Paul, running for president, talks about this all the time. It's a major part of his agenda. He's still in the race. And please get involved in this issue. Tell everyone you know about this creature from Jekyll Island, or watch my second DVD, The Temples of Stone, and I really summarize and encapsulate all of these issues. And tell your neighbors and your friends, because we don't want to lose our money. We don't want to go bankrupt and crash. We all work so hard for our money. And we need to go back to a more solid system based on gold and silver that can be respected around the world. So I'll get off my soapbox now, but I do have to get that off my chest. So now I'd like you all, I'll spend the rest of the show just going through my archives. I have many really amazing shows. I think you can join the archives for $4 a month or something really cheap. And you have access for 30 days to all these shows, you know. So go to Odyssey and click on Archives. And let's go through some of my favorite shows, actually. I'll comment a little bit about each one. I did February 18th, I did a great show on Oak Island. That's mysterious treasure that's been buried in an elaborate trap in Canada, a very deep shaft called Oak Island. And I believe the treasure dates back to the Knights Templar, and it still has not been found to this day. Just so many people have tried to dig into this treasure, but it's a trap. Seawater floods it as you try to get in deeper. So please check out my show on the mystery of Oak Island. And then I had a really great intuitive psychic on December 17th. That was Eddie Connor. And he talks a lot about how to manifest your dreams. And we always kind of in the back of our mind try to maybe sabotage ourselves or think, oh, well, that could never really happen. And he teaches you how to get over that. So that was a great show with Eddie Connor. He's very probably the most high energy guest I've ever had. He may have a show in the future too. We're talking about that. Probably the best show I've ever done is my December 3rd show with Michael Tellinger. And he wrote an amazing book called Slave Species of God, and that's with a lower G, God. He believes like I believe. And he wrote this huge, incredible book about he's from South Africa, and about the gold mines of Africa and the real history of slavery and the mining and precious minerals on this planet, and what human beings were doing here originally, and how we gained our freedom, how we truly gained our freedom. It's an amazing story. Once again, I think the Anunnaki are keeping tabs on us, but they've completely lost control. What they're trying to do, perhaps, through secret societies, is establish a new world order, a one-world government, but I just don't think they're going to do it. So that's a great show, that Michael Tellinger one about the clay tablets from Sumeria. Another really interesting show about astrology I did, really getting into the 12 zodiac signs, and it was October 8th, 2007. That's a truly intriguing show. It's really important to know your sign, your basic sun sign, and your rising sign. Like, I'm an Aries, which is very direct, very black and white, very truthful. We don't play games. We don't beat around the bush. As you can tell from my show, there's not a lot of introduction. I pretty much tell it like it is or as I see it, and we're always seeking the truth, and we're fire starters. We're a fire sign. We're very dynamic people. It's always good to have an Aries on your team in any project who will kick you in the butt, get you moving and going. We're not couch potatoes in any way. So the next show that was really great was September 24th, 2007, and that was Michael Mott. He wrote a great book on caves, caverns, and creatures of the underworld. And we get into the Chupacabra and the Jersey Devil and gray aliens who may very well be from underground. They may establish their bases underneath volcanoes and such and not really be from another planet. Maybe they were a long time ago, but they may have their bases underground. So that's a great one-hour show in the archives. Let's see, I did a really fun one with David Hatcher Childress, a very famous author, August 6th. He's written about 20 books about lost cities all around the globe. He's more conservative. He's, sticking to hard evidence. He's a great author and a great resource, David Hatcher Childress. He kind of hitchhikes around the world with just a backpack. His books are almost like travel guides as well. And he's quite a daredevil. He does things I would never do. And he's been shot at and robbed and all of this. So it's quite entertaining to hear his stories. And I had David Wilcock on discussing Edgar Cayce. And anyone on a metaphysical path needs to really dig into Edgar Cayce's books and his writings. It's very important. When Shirley MacLaine was starting her metaphysical path, she started with the works of Edgar Cayce, if you remember her book, Out on a Limb. It's a great place to start. You might as well start with the most famous intuitive or psychic of the 20th century. So it just goes on and on. I've had all types of guests on. Some are self-improvement. I've had a famous hypnotherapist on, a life coach, someone specializing in wheatgrass juice, and a fun show about mysticism and rock and roll with the Doors, Led Zeppelin, the Eagles, and many more groups. And that was May 14th of last year. So please go to Odyssey, click on my archives, the webpage, and please buy my DVDs and share them. I'll give you a deal. I'll give you my two DVDs for $38. My third one, my new one, is coming out this spring. It's called Mystery Islands. It will be coming out soon, I promise. And that's about it for this week. I'm on every other week right now. So I will see you in 2 weeks, and I thank you for joining me on this Odyssey. And remember always, shells are found on the beach. For pearls, we must dive. Thank you and good night.